awesome. That's awesome. I'm still trying to figure out the walking backwards and the cards. That was giving me a mind bender there. And the, how'd you like the hamburger thing backwards? That's pretty. You won't see that many church services this weekend. I'll tell you that for sure. Hey, you know, that's my biggest hope for all of us today. It's actually the greatest thing that could ever happen to us is to get back. That really is a great thing. I'm not talking about getting back to the good old days, because oftentimes the good old days weren't all that good. I'm talking about getting back to the original design God had for your life. What would happen if we could get back to that original design? Maybe we never actually lived that design that God had for our life. That's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about how that happened in the midst of David's life. It's going to talk about how Jesus ties into us getting back, and then have a personal response time where you might desire to get back to that as well. So let's pray before we do anything else. God, thank you for today and for the ability to look at things beneath the veneer. And I pray that all of us are ready to go there, and all of us would see the picture of our life the way it could be, were we to get back to the original design you've had for us. And some of us are living that design. And so for those of us who are in that place, I pray that you would give us a sense of joy and a resolution to not go back to the way it shouldn't be. And use my words any way you see fit tonight. In the name of Jesus, I pray. Amen. Well, we've been talking about this whole rope and how this rope goes all the way through that wall forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever, and all the way through this wall forever and ever and ever and ever, and it represents eternity. It represents God's plan, his very laser beam plan of all that he's doing and all that he wants to do. And here we are right here, this little scratch, one little scratch in the midst of this. And success is having my heart in the right place, is my heart on the rope, understanding I want to be a part of what God is doing and being a part of all that's happening that's awesome and huger than me, or is my heart on the scratch? You know, living my scratch life, doing my scratch job, having my scratch date, hoping they scratch me the right times in the right places, and then getting cat scratch fever or whatever like that. You know, having just living for the scratch. And last week we took a look at a guy who got scratched completely. It's King Saul. He completely lived for himself, and he got scratched. One of the reasons he got scratched is because he learned something, or actually didn't learn, but he should have learned something that I learned my first car. My son asked me this last week, said, "Dad, how many cars have you had?" I don't know if you've ever done this before or not, but it's an interesting exercise to try to identify if you're over 16, all the cars that you've ever owned. Interesting. I had enough of them. I went back and I kind of recounted them one by one. And I actually think I had them all in order. You know, the highlights were like my 1978 F-250 four-wheel drive with black primer on it. That was my highlight. Actually, right beneath that one was my white CJ7, my Jeep CJ7 before, you know, the testosterone-less Wranglers are out there. You know, those things, they just don't have the testosterone you need. You know, CJ7, that was it. And then my worst was my Volkswagen Rabbit diesel. That was my worst. At least when I got in the car and turned the ignition, I knew it would start. My worst was my very first 1973 orange Chevy Vega. Yes. I say it's my worst, but really, you know, there's nothing like your first. Your first is always the best, you know? And so my Vega was orange, partly because it was painted orange, partly because it was all rusted out. And that's probably why I could afford it. I paid $400 for this thing. And I got it home, and I wanted to do what everyone wants to do, fix their car up. So I've got the Bondo out, and I got the sandpaper. I'm grinding off rust. I'm slapping stuff on. I'm sanding. I had a friend of mine come over who had an air compressor. We hooked up a gun to it. I hosed down my parents' garage. We actually repainted my car right there in my parents' garage. It was white. It looked beautiful. Went to get it inspected, and then something didn't happen. It didn't run. We found out this aluminum block engine had melted and just wasn't any good. And so I had to completely replace this thing. And that was really bad, bad, bad deal. Because you're supposed to paint cars after you get done with the engine work. My car gets all scratched up when I put the engine in and all this stuff. And what's my point here? My point is this. I wanted to do the external of it is what I wanted to do. Why? Because I understood how to do the externals. I could get immediate gratification. I could see it. The internals was a little harder. I didn't fully understand how pistons worked and how carburetors worked. And not only that, I couldn't look at it and get a charge out of it. This is the way we are in our lives. Dealing with the externals is always sexy, and we always get an immediate charge from it. And it's easy. Okay, I lose weight, I feel okay. I gain weight or I gain muscle, I feel good. I can, you know, pop my zits, I can change my hairstyle, I can buy a new wardrobe of clothes, I can learn to pronounce words better, I can do all these things external, none of them bad. They're just easy, they're just surfacey, they're just veneer. But the stuff on the inside, the thing that drives us, our spirits, the things in the inner world, that is an entirely different animal. No one sees when we do engine work and strokes us for it. They might see us when we wax our outside, but they don't see the inside stuff. That's why many of us have spiritual lives that are seized up. It just sees. Spiritually speaking, we are going nowhere. We are stopped dead. We've got the killer job. We look successful. We've got the killer family. We look successful. We've got the good relationship. We look successful. But inside, you know, spiritually, you're going nowhere and fast, and this is not the way your life was designed to operate. So we see in the life of David. He had an unbelievable life. He was a success any way you looked at it. He was a poet. He was a musician. He was a hard worker as a shepherd boy. He was an unbelievable warrior. And he actually comes into the nation of Israel, and he starts making a name for himself. Actually, God starts making a name for him based on how effective and successful he was. So much so that King Saul, the guy who we looked at last week who got scratched, is noticing David come up through the ranks, and he's starting to get a little freaked out. Here's what it says in the book of 1 Samuel in the Old Testament. In everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. Now, when Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. Saul is threatened by David because Saul is all into external success, and he sees David having external success, and Saul's scratch is threatened, and he gets afraid of David. Even though David, because his heart was in the right place, he lived for the rope. He was about something bigger than himself, a vision bigger for himself, a mission beyond who he was. Even though that's where he was, Saul, because he was so consumed with himself, he didn't see that, and he was completely after David. Saul finally ended his life the way that was true to his character while he was a king, in the worst way possible. He killed himself. He committed suicide on the field of battle. David becomes king, and things just start taking off. Things start happening. They start winning battles. He starts building palaces. His fame all across the world increases. And then he falls prey to the scratch. Then this guy who is completely on the rope falls prey. He falls off the rope and he gets scratched. Unbelievable story. It's a story many of us can relate to. Actually, a story all of us can relate to. We might not be able to relate to the specific thing that he does, but the process he goes through is the exact same process many of us are in right now or need to be in. One of the things that happens when you're a success, however you want to define success in your own world, one of the things that happens, very strange, is as you become successful, you get tempted to stop doing the things that enabled you to be successful. The very things that God used to bless you become the things that become tiresome or boring to you, and you just leave those things behind, whatever they are, whether it's a daily prayer time, whether it's a good, strong work ethic, whatever it is. Whatever it is. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to who were married. I said, man, we used to just have a great marriage, man, great marriage. And well, what happened? Well, they dropped something out that was always a part of their great marriage, sitting on the deck and talking, taking walks together, having regular vacations, whatever. Well, something happens when we feel we're okay and on top of things, we stop the things that got us to that place. And so it says in the scriptures that it says, at the time when kings went out to war, David stayed in the palace. Every winter, nomads in other countries would encroach on your national borders because you wouldn't be out there. You'd be kind of holed up in your own palace, holed up in your own central city. And then every spring, you would go back out and you have to beat these guys back. And this was David's deal. He was an incredible warrior. And he should have been out there leading his troops, but instead he decided to stay back. And when he stays back, he's got idle time. And he gets idle hands, and he's got an idle eyes, and he gets his idle eyes and his idle hands on an unbelievable hottie named Bathsheba. He's up on top of the palace and he looks over and there's this woman who is just drop dead gorgeous. She's bathing on the roof of her deal. And he sees her and he's like, man, get that woman over here now. And I'm the king and I'll get what I want and I want it and I want her specifically. Bathsheba comes up. They have an affair. Seems to be just a nice, innocent, gratifying fling. But then it gets complicated because she gets pregnant. David had these guys around him who were called his mighty men. These are the people that he could always turn to. These are the people who were his fierce warriors. These are the people who were his inner circle. And Uriah is one of his mighty men, and he's dissed one of his mighty men. He's done his wife. He's going, oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? He goes, I know what I'll do. I'll send for Uriah. I'll bring him back. He'll come back, have a nice reunion with Bathsheba. And when she gets pregnant, when she starts showing everybody, he'll go, oh, yeah, well, Uriah was back last month. And so, that's what the whole thing is about. So he sends for Uriah. Uriah comes back, sets him up with another love suite, gets a little, Godiva chocolates for him. He has a personal violinist or harpist playing, all these things. And he meets with Uriah, sends him back to be with Bathsheba. But Uriah's a man of integrity. And he thinks to himself, I can't sleep in the feathered bed with someone picking grapes and feeding them for me in the lap of luxury. My comrades, my fellow mighty men are out sleeping in the mud. So he ends up sleeping on the steps. David finds out that Uriah has never gone to be with Bathsheba and he starts getting freaked out. So he sends Uriah back to the front line and gives him a note to give to his commander, Joab. He says, make sure you put Uriah on the front line. Hoping and knowing that if he's in the front line, he'll get killed. And then when Bathsheba gets pregnant, Uriah won't be there to say, wait a minute, I haven't been home the last 9 months. What is that all about? And that's exactly what happens. And so David now not only goes from being a person who is not doing the things that he needs to do that made him successful. He now is an adulterer. He's now a liar. And he's a murderer. All in the same. And you know what he feels? You know how he feels? Fine. He feels fine. He feels totally fine. So I go, how in the world could you feel fine? He can feel fine for the same reason you can feel fine. And the same reason I can feel fine. We think that, oh man, if I ever did those things, I'd feel awful. And yet, aren't there things that you and I do and things that you and I think and say that we really should be feeling bad about, but we don't? Isn't there? I mean, aren't there even whole classes of people in our society who do things that they don't feel bad about? They're called mass murderers or psychopaths or personality disorder types. Or, our bosses or something like that, aren't they? Could it be that we're in the same place as David? We just don't feel it yet. Is that possible? Is it possible that we need to get back to a place of innocence, get back to the place that God has for us? Maybe we've never even been in that place. So David, and here's a knock. The guy who comes to his door is another good buddy of his, a guy by the name of Nathan. And I want to read this story. Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read what Nathan says to David, and then I'm going to read what David says, and part of it's going to be from this passage, and part of it's going to be from Psalm 51, which is something that David wrote in his personal prayer journal. Scholars nearly unanimously believe wrote very shortly after his good buddy paid a visit to him at the palace. And here's what it says. Just sit back. The Lord sent Nathan to David. And when he came to him, he said, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb. He had bought. He raised it and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. His own little ewe lamb, who he hugged and loved and kissed, his own little ewe lamb. Now a traveler, that wasn't Nathan, that was me. Or actually Mel Blanc from Looney Tunes. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that had belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. David burned with anger against the man, and he said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him." Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion. Blot out my transgressions, wash away all my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are proved right when you speak and justified when you judge. Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. Surely you desire truth in the inner parts. You teach me wisdom in the inmost place." David just comes unglued, finally hits him like a freight train. Oh, man, this sin thing, this thing, God, where I rebel against you, I've had this propensity from the day I was born. The day I've been born, I've had these little scratch tendencies, these things that scratch me up from the very beginning. And here I am, and I am busted. I am nailed. And there's four things that David wrestles with to get back. There's four things he deals with to get back. And these are the four things, if I could give everybody in the earth a gift to be able to do these four things and to get back, to turn around, or what the Bible says, to repent, to turn around, man, it would be the greatest gift anybody could receive. Because these are the four things that all of us need to be able to relate to. And they don't necessarily happen in sequential order, but all four have to be there. One of them is emotional distress, an emotional weightiness where we go, oh, what has just happened to me? You know, Nathan comes to him, and based on what Nathan has to say, he gets it. Things start unlocking for him, and he feels this emotional distress. He completely comes unglued. And along with this emotional distress, there was also mental awareness. He has an awareness. He has a mental awareness of what he has done. Now, the interesting thing is, I don't know about you, but I don't feel the things that I mentally think sometimes. And I don't mentally think the things that I'm emotionally feeling. And not only that, but sometimes what I'm emoting doesn't match up with my brain that should be rightly thinking at that time. You ever noticed? You ever have like feelings or you do something and go, okay, now that feeling was not based on reality, knowing what I know now. I mean, we need both of these. And Nathan is his point of clarity on this thing. Everybody needs a Nathan. Everybody needs a Nathan. But people don't need you to be their Nathan. Because if we hear Nathan, I hear so many people go, "Oh man, yes, I'm going to be your Nathan. I'm going to go and tell you everything that's wrong with you. Yes. Man, and please, God's going to tell me first if you're my Nathan before you tell me you're my Nathan. So please, I got enough Nathans in my life. And I ask them to come into my life." This is what David has done early on. Nathan doesn't kind of show up out of nowhere. He didn't just show up out of nowhere and say, "Knock, knock, here's everything you need to know that's screwed up about you." No, he doesn't do that. They've got an ongoing relationship. Some people have said that Nathan's actually one of his mighty men. And David has given him permission to speak things to him. And the question for us, do we have people in our life who we invite to come into our life to speak truth to us, to help us mentally with the things that we need to be aware of, and speak the things that we should be emotionally distressed about? I don't know about you, but for me, and I've got a number of different Nathans. I don't know why, but you almost never listen to them the very first time they say something. In fact, you know, for me, it's not even a week or a month. It's years maybe. Sometimes things that they see are things that they say. But the important thing is you have people who are able to point these things out and help us. And David is beside himself. He's unglued at this point, and this is one of the things that he has going on for him that Saul never had going on for him. Saul fell off the rope. He fell off, you know, he was consumed with the scratch, and he never felt bad about it. David, it was entirely the different thing. And one of the ways, the reason that is he had a Nathan who was speaking truth to him and speaking things that he needed to hear. Who tells you that? Or even that, here's even this. How do we know what's right or what's wrong? How do we know that? How is it that you think some things are right? And I think that they're bad. How is it that there's some things you think that are bad, and I think that they're okay? I mean, who wins over those things? Who just because one person's more of a winsome communicator, who wins over that? This is why this book is just so critical, because it really nails down and puts down, God says, this is all that's on my heart, and this is what truth is. This is where you need to get back to, and this is the stuff that you just can't argue with. And when we don't have something that we can go back to and say, all right, well, who's right and who's wrong? We're going to always go to what makes us feel better, and we're going to stay on our scratch. David falls prey to the same thing that everybody falls prey to who is successful. They go through success self-pity. Success self-pity. Tim Keller, I heard him speak of it, and he spoke to it as majestic self-pity. This happens. The more you're successful in whatever arena you're in, the more you're going to pity the things that are upon you as a result of your success. And the more liberties you're going to give yourself to do things that aren't right. Because you think, oh, man, no one knows the pressures I'm under. Oh, no one knows. You just don't know what I've got to do with you. And you feel that way. And there's maybe a hint of truth to that. There is unique pressures that come with burdens that are put on your life. I remember when we were in the last offices where our staff was, we were renting offices over on Virginia Avenue. And people were always, you know, you saw that graph earlier of attendance. People were always coming going, oh, isn't it great? Church is going on. And I'd be like, yeah, sort of, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of nice sometimes, I guess. Sometimes excited about it. Sometimes I wasn't. I'll tell you when I hated it. I hated leaving the office. Hated leaving the office because all the cars and the staff cars were parked down, you know, in the parking lot. And, you know, the staff really making things happen around here. They don't get staff time. They don't get stage time. But do so much to create the environment around here. And that enables all of us to grow. It's just it's phenomenal the work they do. Well, I would come and when I came down, you know what I saw? I didn't see staff cars. I didn't see people who God loved. You know who I saw? I saw responsibility. That's what I saw. I went, oh, man, what happens if I get up this weekend and I suck? What happens if I'm awful and I tick everybody off and no one comes back? And then all these people, they've left their jobs and I just, oh. Feel this response. And then you start to have this temptation of, well, see, since this is such a unique pressure, then therefore I should be able to da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Or I shouldn't have to, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And this is what happens as you become successful. You just think the rules don't apply to you. You think they don't apply to you. And we see how many senior leaders in national countries that have adulterous affairs, it's really no big deal because that sort of just doesn't apply to them. And some of us, we don't feel bad about it. We've got this clear conscience. Maybe we don't have a clear conscience. Maybe we just have a bad memory. Or maybe we have a conscience that is scorched. You know, there's got to be this connection of these two. And then there's these willful decisions, these decisions we make that are willful to actually get back and turn around. One of the things that I've been really working on the last few months is sarcastic humor. What are you laughing at? Who's chuckling over here? I think that's funny. Sarcasm on you, whoever's doing that. No, I have. I've been made aware of that, and I'm just wrestling with trying to have a sense of humor with people who are closer to me that doesn't come at the expense of them. You know, however good-naturedly it's intended. You know, when you're sarcastic, it just, you know, it stings. And so last week, there was a person that made a recommendation to a team that I was on, and we talked about it and we couldn't come to closure on it. And so I saw this person in the office and I said, hey, we've tabled your recommendation. We'll try to get to that next week. And then I tried to be humorous and I said, it was just that we didn't trust the person who was giving it to us. came out of my mouth. I started walking back. I was like, ah! I went back and said, oh, I'm sorry, man. I didn't mean that. Thought that was it, sort of. Go to bed, and I'm like, oh, man, that was bad. Wake up. Should I call the dude right now? I'm looking at my watch. Should I call? No, I'll deal with it tomorrow. Wake up in the morning. First thing in my mind. So, I had to go to this person and wanted to go and say, hey, look, I am sorry. What I said, I don't even know if somebody heard me. I was completely kidding. It was awful what I said, though. It was sarcastic. It was the very kind of thing I'm trying to get rid of. And I'm sorry if it came at the expense of you. I'm sorry. And then he said, well, what are you talking about? I didn't even hear what you said. I was like, man, shoot, I didn't even have to do that. It hadn't hurt. I wouldn't even have done that, you know. But you make a willful decision to go back and make it right. A willful decision to actually go back and try to patch these things up. And this is what David does. And then on top of that, there's actual physical action. Physical action, not just willful decision to do this when you don't want to, but actual, tangible, physical action. I'll say sorry. I'll make it right. If I've done something that's cost somebody financially, I'll write them a check. If I've defamed somebody's character, I will go to everybody who I've done that, and I will call them, and I will apologize, and I will tell them that I am an idiot. I will physically go back and try to make this thing right. David, unfortunately, can't go back to make a murder right. But he can do everything possible he can to make this thing right, including falling on his face, asking forgiveness of God, being made a public spectacle in front of other people, coming clean. He does the things physically that have to happen. It's interesting with me about this with David. As I look at this, this is exact stuff that I need to do in my personal life. And interestingly enough, these things that David does, it's also the exact thing that Jesus spoke to. It's interesting to me. People were always trying to bust Jesus stump Jesus with a theological question of the day. And so these big religious type would get around him and they try to mess him up. And so finally they said, okay, Jesus, all this stuff in the scriptures, all the Old Testament portions of the Bible, all these scriptures, tell me all this stuff, what is the most important thing? What's the most important thing? And so no matter what he says, they go, oh no, what about? And here's what Jesus says. Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And he goes on and says, love your neighbor as yourself. Heart, mind, soul, strength. I think it's kind of interesting. When I think of the heart, I think of my emotions. I think of my mind. I think about my mental capacity. I think about my soul. I think about my willfulness. I think about my strength. I think about my physical actions. It's interesting. Jesus calls out four things. They're all part of what David does. And they're four things that are always involved in a turnaround. Always. Always the things that take us back to where we need to be. And you know the other thing, interesting thing about it? These are all the four things that Jesus lived his life for. When you take a look at Jesus' life, it is very clear that he was thinking of Psalm 51, the psalm that I read earlier, when David is asking for forgiveness. Jesus is thinking about Psalm 51 while he is on the cross, based on some of the things that he is saying and some of the things that are happening to him. Now, he's never sinned, but he is fulfilling the brokenness that David was going through. He is doing the piece of justice that couldn't happen. Why was David not wiped out? David lived. David ends up getting back on the rope. Hey, he murdered a dude. He had adultery. And yet, he goes through this turnaround process and he ends up getting his previous position and going on. Why is that? How can that be? I mean, I thought the God of the Old Testament was this God of fire and brimstone who just, you know, whack you at a moment's notice. No. No, here he sees this situation. He gives him grace. He doesn't whack him. He should have. That would have been justice. Why doesn't he? Because he knows his son's going to get whacked. That's why. He knows his son's going to get whacked. There's something else interesting here. David ends up having a son through Bathsheba. And part of the punishment that God gives is that that son will die. That son will die. David prays for this not to happen. He asks, he begs for it not to happen. And it happens. God takes the son's life. How could God do that? How could God? I don't know why God did that. I don't know how God did that. But I know this. God had that done to him. God never will ask you to do something he hasn't already done. He will never place a burden on you that he hasn't already borne. His son, Jesus, who always loved his God and people around him with all of his heart, all of his soul, all of his strength, all of his might, took the hit, spreads out his arms, and takes the hit for David, pays the justice for David. The one innocent guy pays the justice for David. You know who else he paid the justice for? He paid it for me for that crappy, sarcastic comment. And he paid it for you for that little thing that's in your life and no one knows about, but you know. He did it for you for that selfishness that's been running rampage and it's getting the most of everybody and for that. And I'm just talking randomly here, but I could just kind of pick out 10 things I know. I tag probably 10 people in here just because I know a lot about you. You know I know a lot about you? Because I know a lot about me. That's why I know a lot about you, because I know a lot about me, because this is the human condition. That we drift off of the rope. We drift off of where God has put us and where God is wanting us to go. And we fall and we need to get back. We need to turn around. And there is evidence that you're in the midst of a turnaround when you have this emotional thing right now, maybe. There's evidence that there's a turnaround. When there's things that are clicking, you're getting real mental clarity that you maybe never had before. There's evidence of a turnaround when you're feeling, man, I can't wait for this thing to get over, not because I'm uncomfortable, but I got to get out of here and I got to make this right. And there's evidence that something is in the midst of breaking in your world and getting you back on the rope. Fascinating for me that when we're broken, which all of us are, we're broken. We're like broken pieces of metal. God doesn't hammer us. You don't take a broken piece of metal and you don't hammer it back together. You know what you do? You melt it. There's fire that comes to forge and melt the metal back. And this is what God will do with you. When you are broken, he'll bring fire. And the fire will melt you. It will dissolve you. It will warm you over. So you come back to the place of wholeness that you have always designed to operate in. And the path back is through the broken one. The broken one who spread his arms wide on the cross and said, I will take the hit and pay the justice for all those who would like to receive me and get back onto the rope. To help us a little bit with this imagery, I want us to take a look at something here on the screen.
About a month ago, I was putting my little boy to bed, and it was 18 months. And okay, God doesn't talk to me. I hear how people hear voices and God speaks to them. And it's never happened to me. But I put him to bed one night, and I'm sitting there watching him. I'm looking at him, watching him sleep. And in that moment, I was looking and thinking, there is nothing that this little guy can do that will make me not love him. There is nothing he can do that I wouldn't forgive. No one spoke to me, but that was about the first time I felt just a little nudge. Like, yeah, that's what it's about. Now you get it. That's what grace is.
God, that guy up there just knew it was time. You know, his time came to that place where he just heard your prompting. He heard it. And there may be people in here tonight that are like that. They've heard it because maybe something that was said clicked with them, or something that they sense clicked with them. Just like he sensed the cleansing that came over him at our recent baptism service. There's a cleansing that you want to give to many of us in here. You know, if you want to say something to God right now in the quietness of your own heart, you want to just confess something to him, you might even want to say to him, God, I want that cleansing. I want you to come into my life. Jesus, I want you at the center of my life. I want to get back to the design you've had for me. Just say it. your own quietness.
I now have joy in my life, and that I can express that joy to other people and express my faith to other people.
I'm not here for myself anymore. I'm here to help other people.
3 months ago, I really took a hard look at my life and decided that Christ was really the person who I needed to follow, because my life just wasn't what I wanted it to be. So I started coming to Crossroads and really had an overwhelming urge to give myself to Christ. And then he said that, you know, there was a chance that I could be baptized. And it overwhelmed me. And I have prayed. And I am so excited to be baptized and to give my life to Christ.
Oh God, I see that, and it just strikes something deep, deep within. And it might be striking some of us deep in here, because that's what we were designed for, to get back, to get back. If you're bowing your head and you're praying, you're just being silent before God, sometimes it helps to mark a moment that says, I want to get back. I want to identify that. I want to look straight to God. I want to look straight to Jesus and tap into His power and His grace. And if that's something that would be helpful for you to mark this moment, and you've never done that before, just while people have their heads bowed down, just go ahead and look straight ahead at me. Just look at me. Mark that moment for you. You know, the greatest thing about this whole story for me is David in Psalm 51, last thing he says to God, in your good pleasure, make Zion prosper. Build up the walls of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the holy city of Zion. It's the capital of the nation. And what happens here? David gets his edge back. He gets his edge back. God's purpose for us is not for us to be down on the ground. His purpose for us is not for us to be emotionally wiped out. We see this with David. Because he gets back on the rope. He gets back. He gets his sanity back. He gets his rope perspective back. He gets his heart back. He's left it all behind and he gets up on the rope. And this is also what God wants from us. He does not want us to just kind of check the right box and who is Jesus. And he does not want us to just get some kind of heaven bus pass. That's not God's thing that he's ultimately doing. What he's doing is having you come to that place so you can get on the rope and be about what he wants in your life. Amazing. God uses broken people like David and you and me, to further what he wants. It's amazing, amazing. God, thank you for today, for every life in this place, and for your life and your patience. Thank you. And I pray these things in the name of your Son, Jesus.